From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In his book, A Fine Romance, writer David Lehman tells a story of a dinner with Cole Porter, Noel Coward, Lawrence Hart, and Richard Rodgers. It was 1926. By then, Porter, a Gentile, had written several Broadway scores without much success. He told his colleagues he'd finally figured out the secret to making a hit. I'll write Jewish tunes. Porter locked into the critical mix of Jewish songwriters, musicians, producers, and executives that helped create American music. And we're exploring that legacy today, warts and all, with Joe Alterman. He's a jazz pianist and bandleader who took over as executive director of the Atlanta Music Festival, which kicks off tonight with Bill Sharlup Trio doing music of Leonard Bernstein at the Atlanta History Center and runs at venues throughout the city until March 16th. Joe Alterman, welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. This is your first year at the helm of the Atlanta Jewish Music Festival, so I'm not sure exactly how Cole Porter would put it, but what to you are Jewish tunes or Jewish music?
Well, that's been the ultimate question since taking on this job. I've always wondered what makes music Jewish. And, you know, often there's been a Jewish performer, but I've wondered, you know, looking at the life of this person, what's Jewish beyond them having happened to have been born Jewish, almost, you know, by coincidence. I came into this job thinking, what really is Jewish music? And I met with a lot of rabbis, a lot of cantors, a lot of music scholars, and I got about 300 answers, and they were all different. And so it kind of occurred to me that maybe this isn't really a thing. And I think people think that Jewish music is a genre of music, but after having all of these conversations and thinking about, you know, what might make this music Jewish, I kind of realized that I don't think it's a genre of music. I think that while many people think, you know, they say congratulations to me on getting this job and that they like that I run the Hora Music Festival, that's klezmer music, and klezmer music is a genre of its own. So to me, Jewish music is actually not a genre, but it's more than a genre. It's actually, the way I would define it is it's a cultural phenomena that touches on every genre of music. And I believe that what makes the music Jewish is not the music, but the story of the music.
Well, let's get into the story. And this largely begins in the late 19th century. We, of course, have no recordings of that, but the oral tradition and later sheet music, what was how they circulated popular music. This was in the last decade of the 19th century. German Jews started publishing houses in New York City known as Tin Pan Alley. This is really early on having a role in the infrastructure or the business of music. Why that role?
Well, you know, one of the things I learned from reading Ben Sidran's book was that pretty much every immigrant group that came to America, except for the Jews, tried to, you know, identified more with the WASPs. And the Jews identified more with the Black community. You know, they took jobs that, you know, the WASP wouldn't take. And at that time, stuff in the music industry and the publishing was not a prestigious job, if that's the right word.
You mentioned Ben Sidran's book. It's called There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. He is among those who are going to be at the festival. And he writes about that a lot, the kind of proximity of the Jewish and Black communities in America's racial hierarchy. You know, they were both kind of near the bottom. So there was a lot of collaboration there. And there's a song, one that you mentioned would be a great example of this. This is They Didn't Believe Me. It's Jerome Kearns, and it's from The Girl from Utah. Let's hear just a little bit of that.
What the cutest little word, like to watch you all the day, and it certainly seems fine, just to think that you'll be mine.
So that is They Didn't Believe Me, Jerome Kern and Herbert Reynolds. I should make sure to give credit. This is from 1914. Kern is thought to be the father of the modern musical. So why is that song instructive for us?
Well, it kind of created, in a lot of ways, the lyrics in American popular song. Basically, before Irving Berlin came around, pretty much every lyricist in America was trying to sound British. But Irving Berlin, because he grew up and Jerome Kern and Harold Arlen, all these people, they grew up in a Jewish Black community. They weren't trying to sound British. They were just trying to reflect the language and the talk that they heard in that neighborhood. So They Didn't Believe Me was huge for American popular music because basically Jerome Kern, instead of saying going to, he had going with an apostrophe. And that was kind of the beginning of an American language in popular song.
Well, you mentioned Irving Berlin, who wrote Alexander's Ragtime Band. Not exactly ragtime music, actually, if the truth be told. But this is a man who became known as the king of ragtime. Is that fair?
I don't know. I mean, basically, I think I don't think he is really the king of ragtime. I think, you know, Scott Joplin would probably be that. But I think Sidran makes a great point about Irving Berlin. And it is that, you know, that the black community really created the swing in the rhythm of the music. But someone like Irving Berlin really helped create a swing in the words. So you can read the words to Alexander's Ragtime Band and not know the melody and just read through it. And it almost, it has a flow, not that dissimilar from a rap in a way. And it's thanks to him that we kind of got that in American lyrics.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that Alexander's Ragtime Band, this original recording from composer Irving Berlin. So we have not just this kind of close proximity of the Jewish and black populations, but also, I think, maybe a shared insatiable sense or appetite to express. And I think for a lot of American Jewish immigrants, to be a part of this larger conversation going on in America. Now, of course, in the early 1916, 1920, so many people, African Americans, made the Great Migration up to the big northern industrial cities. What was going on inside of those cities musically?
It was where all the excitement was. It was kind of where everything was happening. I think a lot of people down south knew of the excitement because they'd see some of these musicians come through. And Chicago and New York was really where it was happening. So I know they wanted to get there. But, you know, in terms of the Jewish people, which is interesting to me, is they were escaping persecution in Europe, and they come here and they think they've escaped it, and then they see the same thing happening to the black community. And for these Jewish people that were in love with music, I know that that was a real big force and inspiration to let these great black musicians express themselves.
Mm-hmm. And help them to do that. There were loads of nightclubs in these big new cities. This was the first decade, the 1920s, that more blacks lived in cities than in the country. So there are places like in Chicago, the mayor was protecting the speakeasies. He wanted to ensure that there was a place where this could thrive. But this also shifts music from, you know, orchestral settings into little clubs and jazz. Like so many African Americans, Louis Armstrong made his way to Chicago. Here he is with the Hot Five doing the song Heebie Jeebies.
There's a heebie jeebies you, see, cause it boy, taste it with a little bit of joy. Say, don't you know it, you don't feel blue. Someone will teach you, come on, and do that dance. They call the heebie jeebies dance. Yes, ma'am, Papa's got the heebie jeebies dance.
So why is that song so significant?
Well, I think more than that song being so significant, I think Louis Armstrong is so significant. He really, I think before him, most, if not all, singers were kind of taught to sound alike. You know, if you listen to opera, there's a goal in mind. If you're a female vocalist or a male vocalist, you have a sound in mind. And then he came around and he just did him. And I think that not only paved the way for American music going forward, but it also exemplifies what America is all about, is to be you.
Well, he also wrote in his biography about the experience of working with a Jewish family, and they gave him his first trumpet? Do you know the story?
Yeah. So he grew up in New Orleans, and he was the Shabbos Goy, which is basically for religious Jews, they don't do any work on the Sabbath, which they don't turn the lights on. So they had him, you know, come over and he'd flip the lights and they'd pay him money. And he got his first trumpet from that. But even more than that, I read some interviews with him years later where he said that this was a religious Jewish family. And he said that they would always sing, you know, Jewish melodies to the baby to go to sleep at night. And Armstrong later wrote or talked about how it was that experience that showed him how powerful music could be. And then on top of that, I don't know, you know, Armstrong invented scatting when he was in a recording session and he dropped some sheet music and he didn't know the lyrics. So he had to do something. So he started scatting. And there's an interview with Mez Mezro, who talked about talking to Louis about that. And Louis said that he was inspired. He got the idea for scatting from remembering the chanting of the Jewish family in their kitchen. And he said that he never talked about that because he thought it would be perceived as making fun of the Jews, but it wasn't.
We're talking about the Jewish contribution to American music with pianist and bandleader Joe Alterman. He's pretty much put together the Atlanta Jewish Music Festival beginning tonight and running through March 16th. Louis Armstrong, also known for bringing the solo to jazz, that he, you know, used to be that everybody was playing music together, but he started venturing out and would do trumpet solos. Was this something that had ever been seen before?
Not really. I think, you know, I mean, there are always have always been solos in classical music, but this was more, you know, the way Louis did it was more in encouraging, you know, himself and others who kind of emulated him to be yourself. And you know, one of my close friends before he passed away was the great journalist Nat Hentoff. And when he would talk about Louis Armstrong and jazz in general, he would say that, you know, what Louis set up with the soloist and the band backing it up, and then people, then the next person taking a turn soloing, but the band, you know, having to, you know, make that soloist sound good. He thought that was the perfect representation of democracy, actually. And I think it's a great analogy. It really is a good exemplification of democracy. And Louis Armstrong really created it.
Well, that jazz music and really helped trigger this new race music, as it was called, craze. A blues singer named Mamie Smith had a huge hit with Crazy Blues. This was in 1920. And, you know, everyone was looking for the next one, you know, the Bessie Smiths, the Sippy Wallaces. But Jews were already in music and entertainment business, so there was a lot of opportunity there for working together, but also opportunities for exploitation. And there are plenty of stories of, you know, claiming credit or paying performance a pittance, you know, or a bottle of whiskey or something like that. Do we know, is that apocryphal? Did this happen?
It did, but I think, and, you know, I'm prefacing, this is not a defense of any of that stuff at all, but I think the story at times is a lot more complicated than it appears on the surface. For example, this is a little further down the road, but when Leonard Chess of Chess Records, you know, would make Muddy Waters share co-writing credit of a song with Alan Freed, the most popular DJ in the country at the time, we all look at that and say that's terrible, and it in many ways is. But at the time, he thought, you know, we want to make money off this record, Muddy included. Why not co-write the most popular DJ in America and help? He's guaranteed to play it more. A lot of times these stories, first of all, are worth exploring with both the Jewish and Black community today. But they're a little more complicated and layered than they really appear just from, you know, one mention of it, if that makes sense.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think we would definitely want to get to that with Chess Records, because that was a big story of the 20th century music scene. My guest is Joe Alterman. He's now at the helm of the Atlanta Jewish Music Festival, and we're talking about some critical points in the history of American music and the Jewish contribution to it. We'll be right back with more on Second Thought right after a short break.
I love you. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay here with you forever. I've got my man. Someday I know he's coming.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Atlanta Jewish Music Festival starts tonight, and we're looking at the significant role of Jewish immigrants and descendants of immigrants in the creation and production of American music. For much of the nation's history, Jews were not considered to be white. They were denied access to industries, good schools, neighborhoods, society, and culture. The burgeoning popular music field in the late 19th and 20th centuries gave them an established industry to put a stake in, not just in business, but new freedom to express their own creative yearnings. And Tin Pan Alley and Broadway and vaudeville and the movie and record businesses were Al Jolson, Irving Berlin, George and Ira Gershwin, Jerome Kern, Leonard Bernstein, countless others wove their traditions and that outsider status into music that was actually more inclusive and indelibly American. Well, we're talking about that history with Joe Alterman. He's a jazz pianist and band leader. He's our guide today. He's also executive director of the Atlanta Jewish Music Festival, which begins tonight and runs at venues around town for the next week and a day, I guess. Among your guests is Ben Sidran. We mentioned it before. He wrote the book, There Was a Fire. This is about Jews and American music and the American dream, as he puts it. And he traces this early Jewish immigrant impulse to create and really a kind of fascination with all things American. And in the book, he tells the story of Albert von Tilser, the man who wrote Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And there's a man who actually never been to a ball game. Now, what does this reveal?
Well, basically, the story is that Irving Berlin had an employer, the guy working for him, who had a younger brother who was Albert von Tilser. And he's reading an article about baseball in a Yiddish newspaper in New York at the time. And he liked the article so much, and having never been to a baseball game, he decided to write a song about the game. And he writes, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And Sidran explains that, you know, he asked the reader to look at the lyrics to the song. And he says, it's kind of about baseball, but look at the lyrics. I don't care if I never get back. It's really about someone looking for a community and wanting to belong to something. It's really an American immigrant story. And I think that really exemplifies the Jewish journey in American popular music. It's wanting to belong. You know, that's the ultimate question for me as running this festival is, you know, when you have someone who, like George Gershwin, who says, I write American music, but they're Jewish, you know, is that shunning your Judaism or is that just redefining what it means to be Jewish in America? And I personally think it's the second. And I think the Take Me Out to the Ball Game really exemplifies that. I think Sidran, he likes to say that, you know, every immigrant group that came to America wants to be American, but also wants to still have a bit of the other, if that makes sense. And I think that kind of exemplifies it.
Well, this is George Gershwin, one of the big giants of the great American songbook, which really began in the 1920s. There were pop hits, film scores for early Hollywood films, songs recorded over and over again through the years. And still today, let's just hear a little from what is generally agreed is a great American masterpiece, George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. So that was written in 1924. Gershwin denied that Jewishness had any effect or influence, let's say, on his music. What do you hear?
Well, it's interesting because the part that everyone says, quote, sounds the most Jewish is that clarinet riff right there. And actually, he didn't write that part. Apparently, the clarinetist kind of improvised it and he decided to keep it in. but, you know, it's interesting just thinking of what makes something sound Jewish. I remember when I was exploring this question of what is Jewish music, meeting with one of the rabbis in town, and he sang to me a prayer, and he said, that sounds Jewish to you, right? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, I hate to break it to you, but it's actually a German drinking song. And many of the most well-known Jewish melodies I found out are actually Jewish word or Hebrew words put to German melodies. So it's hard to say, you know, this rabbi, he basically said, a lot of the stuff that we think of as sounding Jewish, quote, quote, it's kind of like having Chinese food in America. It's really hard to define what makes something sound Jewish. I mean, Cole Porter said he would write in the key of D minor because it sounded Jewish, but I don't really know what that means. But when I listen to Rhapsody in Blue, I really hear a mixture of, you know, it sounds like a big city. It sounds like an American big city. You can really hear that. And I think to me, it's really a mixture of, you know, the great jazz music that was coming out of here and the great classical music that he was influenced by. And I think nothing exemplifies that more by the two people that were, you know, giving a standing ovation at the premiere of Rhapsody in Blue, which was the great jazz pianist who was actually Jewish, Willie the Lion Smith, and Rachmaninoff. They were both in the audience, both giving a standing ovation. And I think that really kind of sums up the sound of that piece, if that.
Yes, it does. But it's also that this was premiered, you know, in a big concert hall. So what did that mean that you talked earlier about, you know, belonging, getting to that baseball game where you were not excluded, where you felt safe, I guess, on some level? What did that mean?
It kind of, in a lot of ways, it kind of elevated like street life to high art in a lot of ways. It was kind of saying, you know, the musical things in jazz is equal and worth, you know, presenting in a concert atmosphere, just like classical music. And it kind of elevated this American, you know, music to a higher level. And it recognized the significance of what was going on in that music.
I want to go back to what you were talking about right before the break, Porgy and Bess. This is 1932. Gershwin composed an opera version of Porgy and Bess. It's set in a black southern town. Now, this was a book by a Jewish couple. There are spirituals in it. He said he considered these folk songs, you know, his interpretation of the black experience. So, you know, immediately people can say that's appropriation. You know, you're making fun of, you're taking from, you're stealing a culture. But it also had black actors singing on stage, extremely rare at the time. In fact, the show was a bit of a dud. It only ran for something like 100 performances before it closed. So again, this question of like, how do you consider this mix of appropriation coupled with opportunity?
Well, it's interesting because I'm trying to remember who actually wrote this, said this quote, but they were talking about this relationship in music. And I think a lot of people think that the Jews might have been appropriating this music or whatever at the time. But really, the quote basically that this guy said was, we weren't trying to help the underclass. We were the underclass. So they didn't feel like they were appropriating something. They were just showing what, you know, they were actually living, you know, their neighbors and stuff like that. It was a community at the time. I think it's hard to know that or to remember that sometime.
I think what I hear in this is this kind of shared yearning to be part of.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, I'll read, you know, Ornette Coleman. He'll talk about, you know, listening to cantorial music and just crying. And he talks about hearing this yearning. And I think even Nat Hentoff would talk to me about Billie Holiday, how he heard the same yearning in her music that he heard in great cantorial music. And I think that definitely it's there. It's all there.
We're talking about the Jewish role in creating American music with Joe Alterman. He's a pianist and composer and head of the Atlanta Jewish Music Festival that's going on for the next 9 days. Well, so what we're hearing here is, you know, Rhapsody in Blue, not necessarily about Jewish identity in music, but a kind of industriousness. And this is at a time, you know, not long after the stock market crash of 1929. Basically, Tin Pan Alley is on the auction block, not doing very well. But this sent musicians that were schooled in that proving ground packing, including a Jewish saxophone player named Arthur Arshosky, who saw Louis Armstrong play at the Sunset Club in Chicago, which forever changed him. He picked up a clarinet, traded in a saxophone, and became Artie Shaw. Here he is performing Nightmare. Pretty ominous song for someone who's known for swing. So why is his experience so important for us to consider in looking at this story of Jewish contributions to American music?
Well, Artie Shaw kind of grew up, I think he grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, and I think everything he did in his life was a result of kind of being made fun of for being Jewish. And it's hard to know what, you know, what that says about the Jewish part of his music. But if everything he did was a reaction to being made fun of for being Jewish, it shows, you know, he was influenced by his Judaism somehow, you know,
in response to or denial of it on some level.
Yeah. I mean, if he's trying to hide his Judaism because he, you know, was being made fun of for it, it's still hard to deny that there's an influence there. And you take the piece you just played, Nightmare was actually based off a cantorial piece. I remember again, Nat Hentoff, the Jewish writer I was so close with, he told me that the reason he got into jazz was he was walking down the street in his hometown outside of Boston, and he heard that song, and he ran towards where it was going, and he said that it sounded, quote, like a chazan swinging, and a chazan is a cantor. And he later met Artie Shaw and asked him about it, and that's when he found out that he was right.
Well, Artie Shaw, a really interesting character, as you said, you know, like bullied as a kid, called Christ killer, you know, all of the things that might have been said at that point. His father was a foreigner, heavy accent. So this is, we see a beginning of a sort of distancing oneself from the heritage, the second generation. But I'm wondering also if that kind of open-ended music became a kind of pathway, I guess, for reinvention.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate goal for a jazz musician is to be able to express yourself through the music. And I think you can't deny that he did that.
You've talked a lot about Nat Hentoff, who, as you said, was a friend of yours. He was a jazz critic for years. He wrote liner notes for loads of early bebop and other records, and also had an interesting relationship with Billie Holiday.
Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Strange Fruit was based on a poem written by a Jew using a Gentile name, and of course a visceral protest of lynching and racism. The song itself written by Arthur Herzog. I'm wondering if the idea of distancing oneself from one's Jewishness in some ways made for more identification with Black Americans.
Yeah. I mean, take someone like Nat, who I would always, you know, I don't know if I would have wanted to take this job of director if I had not known him, because the stories he told me about being a Jewish person in music just were so inspiring. And I realized that I could reflect some of those stories on the festival. But had I not known them, I don't know if I would have. And basically, you know, Nat would talk to me about how back in the 40s, when bebop was first happening, it confused a lot of people. It didn't necessarily catch on. And it really was thanks to people like him and other Jewish writers like Ira Gittler and Dan Morgenstern that would tell the world, this stuff is important. You need to listen to this. And I, you know, to me, that's, you know, I like that there are Jewish performers in the world, but it was stuff like that that really makes me, as a Jewish person in music, proud to be Jewish.
He also helped organize a really important showcase of jazz music, The Sound of Jazz. This was a 1957 CBS television special. Let's hear Billie Holiday from that special singing Fine and Mellow.
He wears high draped pants, stripes are really yellow. He wears high draped pants, stripes are really yellow. But when he starts in to love me, he is so fine.
And since all roads lead to Nat Hentoff, there's also a story about that.
Yes, I was at his house shortly before he passed away, and he was showing me some of his collectibles. And first he showed me a picture of him at the bed-in with John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And I said, wow, how was that? That must have been great. He said, it's one of the worst days of my life as a journalist. I said, what? He said, I'm there for a story. I'm a journalist. And all they would tell me is, we're here for peace. And he couldn't get a story. So he showed me that. I was kind of shocked. And then he moved on to the next piece of memorabilia. And it was a 3-page handwritten letter from Billie Holiday. And he just said, this is a thank you note from Billie Holiday. And then he moved on to the next piece. And I said, no, wait, go back. And he said, you know, basically in 1957, he put on The Sound of Jazz. And I think there was, you know, Billie Holiday was on it. On that recording was Lester Young and Harry Sweets Edison. Yeah. And Count Basie was later in the program. I think Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. I mean, everyone was there. And he said he showed up to the studio that day to film. And the head of CBS came up to him and said, we're cutting Billie Holiday. We don't want a Black woman who's been in jail on our network. And Nat really, he got really angry and he threatened to cancel everything else happening on the program. So they let it stay on, but only thanks to his, you know, standing up for her. And that clip is perhaps her most famous clip there is, and it wouldn't exist without his, you know, being a, you know, a tough Jew.
That song and Billie Holiday, so deeply rooted in the American musical experience. But we didn't really talk about the Great American Songbook, mm-hmm. which I think gets a lot of airtime. You know, a lot of people have talked about how many Jewish composers, producers, makers, musicians helped create the Great American Songbook. How do you think of that legacy?
I mean, I think it's, you know, there's that quote of Nietzsche, you know, without music, life would be a mistake. And I think, to me, the Great American Songbook really exemplifies that, because not only are the melodies beautiful, but in terms of the lyrics, when you look at something, it's not a Jewish composed song, but it doesn't matter. Cole Porter's You're the Top. I mean, to me, I didn't know that humans could be that clever.
But if this ditty is not so pretty, at least it'll tell you how great you are.
Joe Alterman is my guest. He is the executive director of the Atlanta Jewish Music Festival. It's beginning tonight and running through March the 16th. Well, we will be back with a little more on that, the festival, and the rest of the sprawling history when On Second Thought continues. You're the nine, you're the Tower of Pisa, you're the smile. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jewish composers, lyricists, and artists produced a huge share of American music, from George and Ira Gershwin to Barbara Streisand to Bob Dylan to the Beastie Boys. Well, we're talking today not just about those well-known artists, but the contributions of people like Alan Lomax, who made field recordings of country blues, prison songs, and gospel from the American South that are an essential part of America's musical DNA.
Ooh, Lordy, my trouble so hard. Ooh, Lordy, my trouble so hard. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Don't nobody know my trouble but God.
We're also talking about the A&R men, DJs, and producers who, guided by passion and proximity and sometimes greed, stoked a market that thrust African-American artists and music into the limelight. It's a dynamic which cast a long shadow over Black and Jewish-American relationships. My guest is Joe Alterman. He's the head of the Atlanta Jewish Music Festival, and we're talking about that long history. Well, among those who got a really bad rap for exploiting musicians, especially Black musicians, Leonard and Phil Chess is a pair of Polish immigrants. Brothers founded Chess Records. Whole roster of blues and soul and jazz artists. The ATL Collective is doing a tribute to Chess on March 19th. Now, why are you highlighting Chess for this festival?
Well, I did this on purpose because there's a lot of Jewish-owned record labels. You could take Blue Note Records, for example, which is a great story. It's basically the story of, you know, Alfred Lion, Francis Wolff escaping Nazi Germany and coming here and, you know, seeing the similar persecution in America to these Black artists that they loved. So they wanted to let them express themselves however they could. So they did, and they created Blue Note Records, which is a great label, great music, great story. But to me, I think, you know, I struggle with how to say this correctly, but I didn't want to do that for my first year on the festival, because that story is pretty much, you know, a self-congratulatory story. And I think the story of the Jewish and Black communities in American popular music is more complicated than that. And I think it was such an important relationship that has kind of, you know, been lost in a lot of ways over the years. So I think it's worth exploring the more complicated parts of that story first, so it's not a self-congratulatory festival. I think there's a lot of great things Jewish people have done in music, but it's worth exploring everything. And so I think, you know, looking at Chess Records and, you know, involving, you know, not just people in the Jewish community in it, but people in the Black community too, by looking at the complicatedness of the story, you know, there's more chance for people to, you know, it's just a better story, more chance for people to come together around it. And really, by exploring that tricky story, it is a very, tricky story.
Well, let's get into it a little bit. Their father had a junk shop in Chicago. The sons, Phil and Leonard Chess, opened a liquor store in Chicago in what was then called the ghetto, right?
Mm-hmm.
Big success. They opened the Macomba Lounge, nightclub, live music. And Leonard met a woman named Evelyn Aaron, playing poker, by the way. I guess he was quite a gambler, and bought a stake in this small record label called Aristocrat. And then in 1950, he and his brother Phil created their own. The first Chess record that came out was My Foolish Heart by Gene Ammons. Let's hear a little. The Chess label had Etta James, Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Bo Diddley, Buddy Guy, Chuck Berry, all black musicians, which was not an easy sell on the radio in the 1950s. So they're, you know, traveling thousands of miles, going to stock jukeboxes, getting into taverns, dropping off to distributors and DJs to try and get the records played. So they call themselves businessmen, not artists. No pretense there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They call themselves businessmen because they said they identified a market. And, I mean, that's just the beginning of this complicated story.
Mm-hmm. But deep and abiding relationships with musicians like McKinley Morganfield, who is better known, of course, as Muddy Waters. Let's just hear a little bit of this. This is I'm Your Hoochie Coochie Man. This is live at the Newport Folk Festival in 1960.
Hold on. Shawn off I would, oh Lord.
Now, this is Muddy Waters, originally recorded by Al Lomax near Clarksdale, Mississippi. A huge influence, of course. The Rolling Stones named themselves after him. Many, they came when they first came to the United States. They went to Chess Records. And this is where, you know, some of this complication comes from. Keith Richards said he saw Muddy Waters painting Leonard Chess's house. And this is a story that's been denied over and over and over by Chess and their associates. But this was a really complicated relationship. When Leonard Chess did die of a heart attack in 1969, Muddy Waters spoke a few days later on WVON, by the way, a Chess-owned radio station.
Muddy Waters?
Right.
Yes, how are you?
Oh, not too good. I got bad news. We got acquainted in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
So we were pretty close all the way down through the years. So I think he was living, he would say what I'm saying now. He made me and I made him.
Mm-hmm.
He made me and I made him.
Mm.
So interesting. Muddy had the talent. The Chess brothers had the access. Is that too simple of a way to put it?
Not really. I mean, it does sum it up nicely. I mean, the story is, you know, larger and bigger than that, but that might sum it up.
So we got there. But you're really good friends with Ramsey Lewis, who was one of the first artists with jazz albums to hit it really big on Chess Records. Let's first hear a little bit of that. This is from 1966 album Wade in the Water. Ramsey Lewis there, an artist on Chess Records, who you know. What has he said about that time?
It's interesting. You know, we were on the phone one day, and the bass player on that recording you just played is named Red Holt. His real name is Isaac. And the other phone started ringing, and Ramsey says, oh, man, it's Red. And I heard him pick up, and he says, it's hot. And then he got back on the phone. I said, what was that? And he said, that's what Leonard Chess used to call him. And so he was speaking Hebrew, and he kind of, you know, he was kind of got kind of sentimental about the old days. But when I kind of pressed him about it, he would say, you know, there was times when, you know, he would get his check from Leonard or Phil Chess, and he'd also get like a mink coat for his wife, and he as like a quote gift. But Ramsey would kind of be a little, you know, what's the catch here? It kind of felt like that. So it's interesting that, you know, he definitely in a lot of ways made his career happen, but there's definitely some shady stuff there.
But to say that they had the talent, the Chess brothers had the access, is that letting them off too easily?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like, you know, if someone asked you to give a 5-word summary, that's enough. But it is much more complicated than that because, you know, I think it's easy, and I'm not defending the Chess Brothers at all. I mean, Ramsey didn't like say that they were great guys, but I think that just the story is more, you know, complicated.
The record business is a messy business, even for established artists who know a lot more about, you know, the business than Howlin' Wolf might have, or Willie Dixon, you know, Prince, Madonna, very empowered people have had fights with record companies. But as you said, you're doing this Chess Records tribute in order to expose that and have that kind of conversation. What kind of conversations are you hoping will come out of it?
Well, you know, I think it's really interesting looking at just the Jewish involvement in the record business, which I think in a lot of ways might start with Alan Lomax, who would travel the country, and it was simply out of his love of the music and wanting to, you know, document this music that would not have been documented otherwise. And he basically, what he would do is he'd go to someone like a Lead Belly and he would record them and then play the music back for them. And by playing the music back for them, he could convince these musicians that their music had worth and value. And that's such an inspiring story that people like the Chess Brothers did take further, but they didn't really approach it because of they must have loved the music, but they loved the business. And I think that's the main difference there. And I think, it's an interesting story because on the one hand, there is exploitation, but then on the other hand, it's, you know, would this music have been documented without these people documenting it? You know, it's an interesting balance, but it's important to recognize. To me, that's where I think the Jewish contributions to American music is most valuable. It basically, it's these Jewish people who documented black art. And that's where I think Jews added the most value in America. And I think, you know, you can't just say Leonard Chess, you know, is responsible for Muddy Waters. You can't say that. And you can't just say Leonard Chess screwed over Muddy Waters. It's somewhere in the middle. And I think, you know, when I talk to Ramsey and people like Les McCann and Ramsey and all these great black artists who have taken me as a pianist under their wing, I know that my being Jewish had something to do with them wanting to, you know, liking me. It was
why? Because they'd been in the business. They knew this. They knew other Jewish people.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's basically, you know, back then, you know, I'll talk to even, you know, Oscar Peterson's daughter, who will tell me stuff like, you know, back then, a lot of times when there was a Jewish person on their team, it was kind of a relief. They, you know, it was like a, you know, phew, you know, when like Norman Granz would walk out Oscar Peterson to his cab at the end of the night, like it was comforting. And I know that that comfort has been lost in a sense. But, you know, looking at this, you know, the phenomena of how the Jewish community and the black community work together to shape American popular music, I think it's a shame that that relationship has kind of not deteriorated, but in a lot of ways it has. And I think, you know, by presenting a concert like this where it's not, look how great the Jews are, but it's like, look how, you know, great everything we've done together, despite the complications and embracing the complications, is a better way to hopefully, it's a ambitious task to say that it's going to repair the relationship. But I think by trying to, you know, look into the entire story and not just the good stuff, you know, there's more potential there. That's the ultimate goal, is to bring back this Jewish-black working relationship in music.
Well, that is a lofty goal, but that is a great place to start is, of course, doing music. And we are talking about the Jewish contribution to American popular music with Joe Alterman. He's put together the Atlanta Jewish Music Festival pretty much single-handedly. It's beginning tonight with Big Bill Charlap Trio doing music of Leonard Bernstein at the Atlanta History Center. It's running at venues throughout the city until March the 16th. Well, let's talk about that. You know, this record that Bill Charlap and his trio have done of Leonard Bernstein's music, it's called Somewhere. And they're going to be talking about that, playing music from that. But let's just hear one of those recordings. This is Leonard Bernstein's Cool. Well, what makes him Jewish and what makes him American?
Well, I think it's hard to differentiate between the two when you look at him. But I think that's okay. I mean, I think, you know, honestly, well, besides his actual Jewish-themed music, of course, I think that what makes his music both Jewish and American is truthfully the same thing. His music is very expansive, and it's a life-affirming, and it's. I think that's a Jewish theme and an American theme. That, you know, I'll talk to you know, I think a Jewish theme is life affirming. And I think that's, you know, I had a long talk with, not to drop names, but with Wynton Marsalis one time. And Wynton told me he asked every jazz musician that he interviewed, what is jazz? And they all have answered, it's either life or love. And I think you could say the same thing about, you know, Jewish themes. So I think this Jewish theme and the American theme in Bernstein's music is kind of the same thing.
Mm. How about for you and your music? You do original compositions, you do covers. I saw that you did a cover of the Bee Gees' Night Fever. So you're covering a lot of bases there. Do you consider yourself a Jewish musician?
I mean, I'm a Jewish person who plays. You know, I kind of suffer from the same thing that, you know, George Gershwin did, which is basically I'm an American person. I'm an American. But, you know, to me, I think that's where the Jewish part comes back to the story. I don't think I could say that I'm a Jewish musician, but I could say that, for example, when I went to Jewish summer camp growing up and I heard the guitar start, that's when I discovered how everything changed when music started. So it's not that I'm a Jewish musician, but it's that the Jewish influence on my life showed me how powerful music can be. And I think that's what, you know, if anything, that's what makes it Jewish. It's the story that makes it Jewish. But, you know, in terms of my music, I'm not a Jewish musician, but I'm just a musician. That's the tricky part about music in general, is it's for everyone.
Let's hear one of your songs. This is called Softly as in a Morning Sunrise. And I'm asking you, or pressing you on, you know, what is Jewish music, which I guess has been your absolute challenge doing this festival. Where have you come out on this?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. This is basically when I came onto this job, or when I was applying for this job, I met with a lot of Jewish people in town who like music. And I said, who I know who had not engaged with the festival yet. And I said, why haven't you engaged with it? And they said, I either don't like klezmer music, or I don't know what Jewish music is. So I thought, you know, I'll define Jewish music and we'll be cool. And what I realized after having these hundreds of conversations with these rabbis and all these people is that we're never going to define Jewish music. But the confusion around defining the term should not be a deterrent from coming to the festival. It should actually be a reason for embracing it, because these conversations, these answers, they're fascinating. To me, what I did realize is that Jewish music is not a genre of music. And I know people listening will disagree with me, because I've had arguments with many people who say it is. But I think you can't say, you know, for example, someone will say to me, anything from Israel is automatically Jewish music. But there's stuff from Israel that I hear that if I didn't know it was from Israel, I think it's a modern American pop group. Or anything in Hebrew is Jewish music. And I was sent a band that sings Johnny Cash songs in Hebrew. Could that be Jewish music? Someone told me it's anything based off the Torah, which, you know, makes a lot of black spirituals Jewish music. Someone else told me it's Bob Dylan or Jerome Kern. You know, everyone has a different definition for it. And we're just, it's going to be confusing. But I think that as a community, we can embrace that confusion, because that's, you know, that's Jewish music, that's American music, that's Judaism, and that's America in a lot of ways.
Joe Alterman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Joe Alterman, he's a pianist, he's a composer, he's a band leader, and he's the executive director of the Atlanta Jewish Music Festival. It's starting tonight with a concert at the Atlanta History Center and running until the 16th. You can find much more on the On Second Thought page at gpbnews.org. That is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, Amelia Brock, and extra special thanks to Elena Rivera today, and also to Bill Nygut and to Bram Sable Smith. Alex Word is our engineer, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for joining us for On Second Thought.